Welcome back to Whence Can You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, this is episode 376. Wow, 2019. It's hard to believe that our first episode was 8 years ago. It's pretty insane, back in 2011. Anyway, it's been an incredible ride. We've had lots of really great topical discussions, educational papers, interesting guests and authors, and it's just been awesome. And here we go. We're starting a whole new year, so we can look forward to a new episode every single week of this year. Again, with the exception, of course, is the last 2 weeks in December. We'll take those off as always. So 50 episodes this year. By the end of the year, we'll be at about 426 episodes. Just wild. Do we put a stop on this? How do we continue to go? Do we go to 500 and start a new show? Do we go to 500 and make a firm commitment and stop after just 500 episodes? I say just. Do we stop after 500 episodes and call it quits? What do we do? Should we start a whole new show and tell you all about it and see who subscribes and just do nothing but esoterics and that kind of thing, or just continue what we're doing? I don't know, but whatever we do, we'll make sure that we're taking our suggestions and our keys from the market, letting the market decide where this show goes. And the market is you guys, the listeners. You tell me what you want and what you want to hear. And if you don't, I largely just have to look at popularity of episode downloads. So that's where we'll have to make our decisions from. Of course, our show is listened to. We have over 2 million listeners. That is incredible. We have more people listening to this show than our members in the United States. So we, of course, have profane that listen to the program. We have people who are about to ask to join the fraternity listening to the program. We have members listening to the fraternity. And, of course, we have a multitude of other groups that listen to this show, including Golden Dawn members, OTO members, Co-Masons. We have LaDroite Humane. We've got a whole gamut of listeners to this program. And I just want to say thank you to everybody out there who does listen, and it's just incredible. But it's January. The month is one of rebirth, as it were. We hit the winter solstice. The days are getting longer, and they will continue to do so until the summer solstice. And so, with every day that passes from now until then, the days are a little longer. And that's wonderful news for all of us. So, this episode is a very special one. Before I left on break, we had quite the number of posts on blogs and Masonic news sites across the interwebs relating to the topic of the future of Freemasonry. Are we refining? Are we dying? Are we something in between? What's going on? There was some contention between Brother Lance Kennedy, I should say perceived contention between Lance Kennedy, Brother Lance Kennedy, and myself, seeing two different trajectories or two different reasonings of the craft, or maybe even two different definitions of what's going on. And after a few times that we had talked online, we really kind of hit off it. We had a good friendship, I think, and brotherhood always prevails. And anyway, I decided to see if he would like to come on this show and to talk a little bit about what he thinks the fraternity is doing right, wrong, what our fraternity might need to do in the future, and possibly where we will be in, say, 20 years or so. What needs to be done? And we just talked about all manner of things, Masonic membership and the entire range of subjects. So that is in this episode. I'm really happy to announce that Brother Lance Kennedy and I had a great interview, and you'll hear that in just a few moments. The Whence Can You podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Masonic Revival, contemporary Masonic designs made for today's Freemason. You don't have to settle for throwing a plain old square and compass on anything anymore. Now you get something truly designed and truly wonderful. Whether it's aprons, awesome pins, and wonderful neckwear, bow ties, ties, pocket squares, you name it, Masonic Revival has it. Head on over to MasonicRevival.com and check out what they have to offer. If you use promo code WCY at checkout, that means free shipping also. And make sure if you see Brother Edgar, tell him thanks for helping bring this program to all of you. And this program is also brought to you by all of you, those of you who support this program. We can't do it without you and your donations and all of your assistance, so thank you so much. To find out more about how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There you can make direct donations, sign up to be a monthly contributor, a fellow, or even a producer. And thanks very much to everybody for donating. And just a couple more announcements before we get into the interview. I recently started kind of a new venture that is, well, it's a business. And it's very niche market. It is called Skull and Crown Limited. It is under the WCY Media umbrella. Skull and Crown Limited is a place where you come to get quality stationery, greeting cards, and other interesting occult and Masonic themed secretarial things, usually. And so we'll have nice papers, and I said we had greeting cards, so we were commissioned to do our first greeting card recently, and we did that. It was a limited run and very popular. So we don't have a website or anything yet. It's just in its very beginning stages. We're not formally launching anything, but if you'd like to check it out, head on over to Facebook and just type in Skull and Crown Limited and give us a like, and we can gauge some interest there. That's where you'll hear about new things happening with that. I'm not going to bombard the program or anything. We might every now and then announce something interesting. And the next thing that I wanted to go ahead and mention is the Esotericon that's coming up. We scared a few of you last week with a totally obnoxious advert for the new Esotericon that's happening. And so here's your fair warning, brothers, and anybody listening. It's about to get obnoxious for just a couple seconds.
Special announcement! Special announcement!
Hi everyone, this is Brother Joe Martinez from Manasseh Lodge number 182 in Manasseh, Virginia. I first wanted to thank Brother Robert and the Whence Came podcast for allowing me a few seconds to announce a very special event. On June 15th, 2019, we will be hosting the first ever Mid-Atlantic Esotericon in Manasseh, Virginia, and tickets go on sale today. This will be a jam-packed event full of esoteric presentations from many of your favorite speakers, to include John Ruark, Frater O, Greg Kaminsky, P.D. Newman, Pierce Vaughn, Jamie Lamb, Don McAndrews, and your very own Robert Johnson. In attendance will be some of your favorite vendors and authors, which we will soon announce, and the event will include presentations for both the Master Mason as well as those that are interested in learning more about Freemasonry and the more philosophical aspects of the craft. We will be kicking off that weekend's festivities with a social event at Sinistral Brewing Company in Old Town Manassas on the evening of June 14th. Tickets for the social event are very limited, and it will be a private event in a great venue with much fellowship to be had. If you're looking for an engaging, thought-provoking, and esoterically focused event, you will not want to miss this. Please check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/MAEsotericon for ticket links, further information, and news updates as we post them. Again, a most hearty thank you to my dear friend and brother, Robert Johnson, for allowing us a few brief minutes to tell you all about this amazing event, which we are all excited to host. Seating is limited, so get your tickets now. And as one of our co-hosts, Brother John always says, keep searching for more life. You'll be sure to find some in Northern Virginia in June of next year.
Saturday, June 15th, 2019, your path to apotheosis starts at the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. Get your tickets. We'll see you in the Playroma.
All right, again, don't mean to scare anybody with those giant shotgun blasts, but I certainly wanted to get your attention. This is going to be quite an amazing event. Brother Joe has been a supporter of this program. He is one of our foremost producers of quality Masonic education by joining many of you as producer-level people to this program. Joe loves Masonic education. He lives for it. And he is in the area where John Ruark, the mastermind behind the Masonic Roundtable, the other podcast that I'm on regularly, along with Jason Richards, also on the Masonic Roundtable. There's going to be some incredible guests at this thing. Jamie Lamb is going to be there. He wrote the Myth Magic Masonry book, which so many people are digging on right now. Brother P.D. Newman, I believe, is going to be there as well. I'll be there talking most likely about quantum entanglement and the idea of apotheosis. So that should be pretty awesome, a good time. We'll be asking questions, and don't waste any moments here thinking about whether or not you should or shouldn't buy a ticket. If you're in the area, do it. You will not be disappointed. If you're not in the area, it's a little drive or whatever, consider it. I think it is going to be a well worth your time event. It's essentially for those Masons out there who really feel like there's something deeper in the craft than just ritual. I think this is right up your alley. It's what you've been waiting for. Maybe this is a model for how every lodge meeting should be. Who knows? We'll see. Anyway, let's get into this really rad interview with Brother Lance Kennedy. All right, everybody, we are lucky this week to be joined by the one and only Lance Kennedy, of course, a Texas Mason. Brother Lance Kennedy was cool enough to give us some time out of his super busy schedule to come on the show and chit-chat a little bit about all things masonry, but particularly a little bit of our future and how we can shape that for a better success, I think. So, Brother Lance Kennedy, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Hey, man, I gotta say, huge shout-out on your articles. I know we disagree on some points, but anybody listening out there, Brother Lance Kennedy and I have been chit-chatting over the last week or so, and we find some common ground, which I think is really interesting. So brotherhood always prevails, it seems.
I agree completely, and I don't even know if we really disagree that much. It's more of, I think, nuances and how we want to phrase things, but we can get to that.
Yeah, for sure. So first and foremost, let me ask you, for the brothers out there who might not know your work, which is kind of unbelievable, right? Unless you're living under a rock. You've had some really massive articles that have come out. And I say massive, not in terms of like length or scope, but in terms of the traction that they get online. They start some really amazing conversations. So why don't you let us know, where were you made a Mason?
Well, I was made a Mason in University Lodge 1190 in Austin, Texas. University Lodge is a lodge that was founded on the University of Texas at Austin campus in 1922. It subsequently moved off of campus and doesn't really have a direct connection with the university, but many of the members either went to the University of Texas at Austin or work in the Capitol, which is a mile south of the campus itself. So when I was a student at UT, I was a Longhorn, and that was the lodge that I decided to join, in part because of the name, and then the culture also spoke to me. So I became a Mason there in 2007.
You know, that's about the same year I became a Mason, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it sounds like we've been in right about the same amount of time, which I think is interesting, too. Do you ever, I don't want to dive right in just yet, but I feel I should ask you, because being made a Mason in 2007, we're young Masons, really. Do you ever get pushback on some of your viewpoints, without going too deep in, from people who say, ah, you're too young, you don't know what you're talking about?
I've gotten some pushback here and there. I don't really feel like that's been a consistent critique of my writing or opinions. I think that when I tell people I've been a Mason for 11 years, they're surprised, because they'll assume that I was recently made a Mason, or maybe have been a Mason for 1 or 2 years. So I go visit lodges, many times I've been a Mason longer than most of the senior members, if not the officer line.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? It's because we're younger. We're younger fellows. I mean, you're younger than I am. I'm 37. I don't know how old you are. Do you mind sharing?
I'm 31. I'm 31 years old. Turned 31 this year.
Yeah, so, I mean, I make the cutoff just barely, 1981. I'm the first year of a millennial. So I get it all. I get called a Gen Xer and a total millennial slacker.
I think and maybe this is probably the most millennial statement I could make, but I don't necessarily feel connected with the core of the millennial generation.
Yeah.
There's a lot of popular culture that I grew up with from the 80s and late 70s that I feel, you know, drew me to the latter, you know, Gen Xers to some degree. But then there's a kind of a familiarity with technology that came about with the millennial generation. So I think, you know, maybe that core of the 1980s, 81 to 88 or so, and I was born in 87, I kind of feel that that could be a crossover either way, depending on where your pop cultural spectrum, where were you? You know, did you relate to Star Wars and Thundercats, or was it later stuff from the 90s? It just kind of depends.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Those kind of monikers are interesting because they're more socioeconomic than anything else.
True.
Let me ask you, what drew you to Freemasonry? Why did you join?
Well, it's a good question. I feel that what drew me to Masonry was a long-term interest and fascination with Freemasonry. I grew up in a family where I heard about Freemasonry and my ancestors, being members. I didn't really have a direct connection or any type of direct exposure with the fraternity. I believe, one of the first Masons I actually met was the funeral home director for my great uncle's funeral, who was also a Mason. And I remember I was about 15 or 16, and he had a Masonic ring, and I was just fascinated by it. I had always wanted to be a Mason, I think, since I was a kid, or at least know about it. And when I turned 18, I, tried to be a Mason, but at that time, the youngest you could be was 21 years old. But a year or two after that, the time frame in Texas changed, and I was able to join when I was 20 years old. I subsequently found out that I had ancestors in the Republic of Texas who were actually Freemasons, and officers in lodges such as Marshall 22, which I visited, actually. So, I know that my Masonic ancestry goes back to at least the 1840s, but possibly before that, since I'm Scotch-Irish and, Scotland is some of the oldest lodges in the world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Researching my own Masonic history, I didn't really have any. We found out just recently, probably 2 years ago, maybe three now, that Gilbert Lafayette Johnson, my great-great-granddad who fought for the Confederacy, was a Mason. I found his tombstone down in Pope, Arkansas, of all places. And just really interesting. And my family, our roots are in Herefordshire, England. So, it makes me wonder if there were more and where they went, but pretty fascinating to say the least. You mentioned that you had a lifelong fascination at the point with Masonry. What did you want to find within Freemasonry? Were you one of these guys who looked at it as a place to go to join an organization to find more affluent friends to be around? Were you, and I don't mean affluent in terms of money or anything like that, I mean affluent in the terms of a higher calling of friendship and brotherly notions, or were you pushed in after a military service? Or what drew you to Freemasonry overall?
Well, I don't feel it was fraternal, fraternalism or any type of desire to have a friend group. I always had a good-sized friend group and never had a problem meeting friends. I think that more or less the reason that I joined Freemasonry was the idea of mystery, this mystique where you see rings and you hear rumors and mentions of Freemasons, tied to things like the American founding and so forth. And whether or not I got into some of those conspiracy theories, I really didn't. I just still felt there was something mysterious that drew me towards this fraternity that, had this track record of centuries, if not millennia. And that prompted me to join. I think, that which we don't know is attractive. And we can maybe talk about this now, we can talk about it later, but I think that's been a real problem with our fraternity as we've tried to downplay our secretness and expose ourselves to the community to the point that there's nothing really attractive about our mystery.
Yeah, we can get into that just a little bit. I'll second your notion there. It has long been a frustration of mine. John Ruark and I, if you don't know, he is a co-host of Masonic Roundtable with me. He and I saw eye to eye almost immediately. Our biggest pet peeve in Masonry is the saying, the biggest secret in Masonry is that there are no secrets. That is, to me, the most gross thing that we've ever said. One of the most upsetting things that I think we've ever said. Feelings on that?
Or to be one asked one, or cheesy, so cheesy bumper stickers, or open houses, or one day festivals. I mean, you can go through the litany of these I'll just call it what it is. It's the post-World War II boomer kind of mentality of we want to make everything open and accessible and friendly and sparkly and nice, and that's going to attract people. And then you look at the lodges that are growing and they do the exact opposite, yet our kind of collective leadership turns a deaf ear, or rather wants to be willfully blind. And we can talk about specific jurisdictions if we want, but I agree completely. This idea that we have no secrets, we have no mysteries, that's going to somehow benefit us. That's basically selling our inheritance for a mess of pottage. to quote scripture.
I think that is interesting to note. You know, I know a lot of boomers who have been in the fraternity for a long time, and I find that that is somewhat of the case. And then I find some newer boomers who are members that are more like you and I, in this mindset of the mystery. Of course, they love the brotherhood and that kind of thing. I think that's just maybe part of the generational scope. Let me ask you this. Did you read McNaughton's book?
What's the title of the book? And then I can tell you if
so
I did.
The title of that book is Reclaiming the Soul of Freemasonry. McNaughton, Sovereign
No, I haven't read it.
Northern Jurisdiction basically makes the case that millennials are great, but we really need to focus, if we're going to save the fraternity, that we need to focus on the baby boomer generation to join, because they're the ones who have the time to dedicate to the fraternity right now. How do you feel
about
that? That's
absolutely not correct. I mean, I'll just go ahead and categorically disagree with him. Is McNaughton a boomer? Well, of course he wants people like him to join. I mean, the truth is that the baby boomer generation within the next 20 years is going to be decimated just through natural causes and linear progression of time. We shouldn't even necessarily be focusing on millennials at this point. We need to be focusing on Generation Z, the oldest members of which are 18 are able to join most jurisdictions, become Masons. You know, we're so, I don't know if you call it retroactive in our thinking, but we constantly think, oh, it's now the boomers, the Gen X, the millennials. It's like, no, we need to be thinking about the up-and-coming generations, their needs and wants, and how to cater to them. And, you know, I personally think that which is timeless caters to all generations, right? So what Masonry has always attracted has been the mysteries. It wasn't until post-World War II in the United States that we became this kind of mass fraternal organization that started opening up and becoming extremely public with our open houses and the like. And so I don't want to paint too broad a brush against the baby boomers or the, you know, post-war generation, but I'll just say more often than not that is the case. They're not interested in the mysteries. They're not interested in any type of elite masonry, or I know that's a naughty word. We don't want to say elite, but I like to remind everyone that we basically exclude about 75% of the population out of hand. If that's not elitist, then I don't know what is. The idea that we should be plebeian and open and just give away everything we have and make it as cheap as possible is, in one hand, it's very American, right? I mean, making it level and so forth to the most common denominator, but it's very counterproductive. But I will give examples of baby boomers that I think are extremely beneficial fraternity, one of which is John Tolbert in San Marcos, Texas. John, almost single-handedly, and he'll probably disclaim this, but I think it's probably true, he basically single-handedly resuscitated San Marcos Lodge, which anyone that's visiting Texas should absolutely check out San Marcos Lodge. It is one of the coolest lodge rooms I've ever been to. That lodge is filled with young guys very interested in the mysteries and esoterica. They have extremely mystical, esoteric lodge room that they've decked out with, you know, symbolism and so forth. It's not your typical, you know, fluorescent lighting with a drop ceiling. I mean, they really did a good job to make it aesthetically pleasing and conducive for kind of a mystical transformative experience. So John Tolbert's a good example of baby boomers. My personal mentor, Fernando Albernoz, in Austin, Texas, he's the president of the Scottish Rite Board of the Valley of Austin, and he, you know, he's a great guy as well, same age group. So there are baby boomers who understand what Masonry needs, and they're very helpful. I would just say, as a generation, though, we can kind of generalize and say their desire for Freemasonry is, I think, at this point, counterproductive and the opposite of what younger generations want in general.
Fantastic points. Just out of my own personal experience, my subjective experience within the craft, a personal anecdote of mine that you might find somewhat amusing was, you know, I was a district deputy grandmaster for a few years, and I recall at a meeting that a Grand Lodge officer, we had a quarter or a monthly meetings for our DDGMs, and so in this particular meeting was for the northeastern area of the state, and I remember a particular DDGM said, well, I don't really get into any of that esoteric stuff. This is really about fraternity, administration, and charities for me. And I remember another DDGM who I had gone head-to-head with in meetings and got into shouting matches over things. He turned to that gentleman and he said, well, you better get into it because it's real and it's been around for hundreds of years, arguably thousands of years, but
I just found it so amazing that he would just say right out like that, now, I'm not really into that. That's not my thing. I'm into this for the administration, the brotherhood, and the charities. That's what this is about. And it's interesting because that is the mindset that I saw coming from McNaughton. You know, the Scottish Rite Northern jurisdiction was in a place for a long time that I felt was very counterproductive to Freemasonry in general. Then in an unprecedented move, they announced Dave Glatley to take over, and Dave Glatley came out and he brought up at least educational programming, and people seemed to really enjoy it. And in fact, I had demitted from the Northern jurisdiction for over a year due to my avid disagreements against the decisions of that organization. We've talked a little bit about some of the things that are challenges within Freemasonry right now in terms of generational gaps and misunderstanding and the almost misalignment of why certain people join. Like for me, I have said before that people have joined and often join for the wrong reasons. And if those people can just creep away, I feel like the fraternity can reestablish itself in what it should be doing. So where did you come from and why did you start writing? What was your first article? What got you going?
I typically write articles to kind of encapsulate one idea. So the very first article that I wrote that went viral that kind of established me as a Masonic commentator, and probably without being too bold, probably one of the most widely read Masonic commentators around right now, was 10 Propositions for Texas Freemasonry. And that was published last year. I had an unprecedented amount of exposure I'll say 5 or 6, but it could be more Grand Lodges that contacted me from several different countries, Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., in particular, that Grand Officers read the article and so forth. So that was really the first article that began this kind of path as a writer, where I don't even remember what caused me to write, but I remember waking up at about 3 a.m. and feeling compelled to write. You know, I just said, okay, I got to say something. I think I was just frustrated at that point with a lot of the areas in Masonry I felt were just decaying, and, you know, people were missing the point and kind of not doing the steps that we needed to do to kind of protect and save and promote the craft. I wrote that article. It got me a lot of exposure, but I waited one more year to write my second article, which is the one that I think brought you or myself to your attention, which was Freemasonry is Dying. And I must add, I actually didn't name the article that. The editor of the website did. He took some of the phrasing that I used about dying, which I did say, but the original name of the article was a little bit less bombastic, and that was The Decline of Freemasonry, an Analysis. But yeah, the Freemasonry Dying was the one that I most recently wrote and garnered me quite a bit of attention.
I just remember seeing that article and I was like, wow, here we are. Like I said, I had wrote an article that was, we talked about our differences in refining versus dying, that kind of thing. And I did that a couple of years ago because of some statistics that originally appeared on Reddit. It was, a standard projection chart just done with a tool in Excel. And then John Ruark did a whole bunch of work with his survey data and was looking at why there was the decline. And overall, his data really shows the idea of NPD and showed that if you really want to save Masonry in terms of membership, then for every guy who dies, you need to raise 3 dudes.
I understand the numerics, and I think in my article, Freemasonry is Dying, I talk a lot about the decline of Freemasonry based on numerics and number of Masons, because I think that's just generally a good indicator. It's one of the only indicators we have and data sets we have that shows this is where we're at and this is where we were and this we're at and this is where we can be. So I don't necessarily believe fewer Masons is a bad thing, but I do think the consequence of fewer Masons with a lack of adaptation is a bad thing. And that's why I claim that we're dying. It's not that getting smaller is a bad thing. Fewer Freemasons is a good thing. I don't necessarily think that's going to be some type of detrimental feature. What I do feel is detrimental is that if we don't come to terms with there's a decline and we continue business as usual, we'll expend resources and time and energy in trying to prop up a infrastructure designed for 4 million Masons with 1 million or less or fewer Masons. And in doing so, we're going to expend a lot of energy, whereas what I'm advocating in my article that just got released, True Trajectories, is a intentional consolidation of lodges, of resources, of charities, of really tightening down the hatches and just saying, you know, we're going to have fewer Masons, that's fine, but we need to make the adjustments now so that we don't have to make emergency adjustments in 15 years.
So let me ask you a few points in this. So I would guarantee that likely, probably 40 to 60% of the audience for this show will or have read your article, which of course will be in the show notes. But of course, at the time that we're recording this, it really hasn't made that many rounds. I think it was posted for a minute but it'll be out by the time you guys are listening to this for a few weeks. But this latest piece you did was really fantastic. I have to applaud you on it. I read it. I sent it over to my best friend Scott and I said, did you read Lance's latest article this morning? He goes, yeah, I saw it. I sent it to some high ups. That's all I'll say. And, you know, we haven't heard anything back on that. In it, you lay out several points which are kind of like answers or steps that we can take to prepare for a diminished number, that you talk about the consolidations and things, and in it you compare with two cities. So you're using Detroit and Pittsburgh in these examples. Let me ask why you felt that was relevant.
Well, I mean, look, if you take a step back before I answer that question, if you want to, you know, answers from the mind of Lance Kennedy for this diminished number and how we can improve it, just take the 10 propositions and then the 5 or 6 answers that I give in the 2 trajectories, some of which overlap, and that gives a pretty broad swath of how, you know, I feel Masonry can improve and really, I think, prepare for, as I say, this kind of decline, which will, in my mind, and what the data shows, continue for the next several decades. So to kind of illustrate this point, though, of why we can take, you know, different course of actions, and different course of actions will have different effects, I illustrate the point through the story of two cities, Detroit and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Detroit took a path, and just to kind of clarify, both of these cities were extremely prosperous for many decades in the first half of the 20th century. But in the late 1960s, the global economy changed, and both cities began a downward trajectory economically. They started having negative population growth. Factories, car factories, auto industry started shutting down in Detroit, and the steel industry and other smelting facilities started shutting down in Pittsburgh. And both cities bottomed out sometime in the late 80s to early 90s. And they tracked almost identically when you look at just number of jobs in terms of loss. Well, from 1990 or so through the 90s to the early 2000s, yet again, both cities tracked almost identically in terms of growth and rehabilitation of their labor market. But if you look at what happened in the early 2000s, around 2005, 2006, the eve of the Great Recession, Detroit's economy labor pool took a nosedive, and it only sped up after 2008 in the financial crisis. Whereas Pittsburgh leveled off and was able to maintain a semblance of normalcy and prosperity during that troubled economic period. Now, many commentators, and I cite Paul Krugman as well as the Brookings Institute, they looked at these two cities and they said, what caused them to track similar economic trends for basically 30-plus years and then all of a sudden diverge in a dramatic fashion? And the conclusion that both Paul Krugman and the Brookings Institute had was that Detroit, during the period of decline, continued to sprawl. So it didn't condense or focus on its core. Instead, it tried to prop up these far-flung enterprises, maintain services to, you know, the random odd house in this abandoned block and so forth, which really passed and strained the infrastructure. Whereas Pittsburgh condensed its city by de-annexing, by selling off property and so forth, and that would reduce the burden on utilities and services to its most central core. And a proof of this was the distance of the labor pool. So percentage of the labor pool within 3 to 10 miles. It was something like 25% of the labor within Pittsburgh's metro area is within 3 miles of its urban core. Whereas, you know, in Detroit, it's something like, you know, I want to say there's in a single digit. So there's a great disparity of the amount of consolidation in the two cities and how they were both able to withstand a crisis and a decline. While it's not a perfect picture for Freemasonry, I do think it teaches us some great lessons about organization and kind of how to withstand, you know, these types of trends and trajectories. We can choose the path of Detroit, where we can keep trying to prop up this massive infrastructure, you know, built for a population 2-3 times the size, or in our case, 4 times the size plus, or we can follow the path of Pittsburgh, admit that we have fewer people in our organization, or in Pittsburgh's case, it's city, and really focus on the core and support the core at the expense of the periphery. So in Masonic terms, this would be the Blue Lodge. We really have to focus on making Masons, doing a really good job of strengthening our lodges, and that means we're going to have to make some difficult decisions about peripheral organizations and services and so forth.
As I'm listening to this and you know, I've read your article, I can't help but think about some of the medical field. Essentially, you know, when I think about this, I think about fight or flight response, right? So in the fight or flight response, adrenaline actually kicks all of the blood to your arms and legs, right? In some cases, that's what causes butterflies in your stomach. You get anxious, the blood rushes away from your stomach, and the butterflies you feel are palpitations in your stomach because it's trying to contract to get more blood. Or like in the opposite is when we are, like in your Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania model, we look at freezing to death. All your blood pools and comes together to protect your most vital organs, leaving your arms and legs to fend for themselves. It's a protection of resource. And I just think, like, that's immediately where my mind went. But let's talk about those arms, those legs, those digits. What do we want to protect? Obviously, the Blue Lodge, the ritual experience. But what do you think we can just say, look, it's going to suck to lose this pinky, but or, you know, whatever that is. What are those things that we're going to lose? What do you think we need to definitely, without question, just say, look, we love you guys, but we got to go?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And kind of the litmus that I kind of lay out in my article is anything that does not enhance the initiatic experience for a Freemason is superfluous. And while they may be able to be their own organization outside of the fraternity, any type of help we may give them in terms of time or resources or promotion is time wasted. And these types of organizations, and I list them in my article, are such as Order of Eastern Star, DMOA, Rainbow Girls. If your jurisdiction still has Job's Daughters, that's another one. I'm not a particular fan of the Shriners or the Grotto. I think that we could maybe wait to make a determination on those organizations, but do they really help promote the initiatic experience of Masons, or are they a liability? And in many ways, they are a liability. I'm not against, I don't drink, but like the idea that we shouldn't have alcohol in lodges, I think it's stupid, right? I mean, it's just straight up. It has no other word, it's stupid. It comes from kind of a puritanical attitude in the United States. However, I don't necessarily think the way that the Shriners go about drinking many times is beneficial for the ideals of fraternity. So maybe that's something we should look at. I'm gonna vent a little bit if I may.
Go now.
I've heard this refrain because I'm a big proponent of academic lodges. I'm a member of an academic lodge. I think that academic lodges, and those are lodges that basically mandate that members be affiliated with a particular university, faculty, staff, students, alumni, etc. One of the criticisms I hear frequently of academic lodges is that they're going to turn into some type of debauched frat house over the life. And, you know, there isn't a single instance of that in any academic lodge in the world, but there's plenty of, you know, Grand Lodge sponsored organizations that are patently debauched frat houses, right? I mean, they're great examples of those. There are many organizations, though, that, and I gave some of those examples, the Order of the Eastern Star, DMOA, that while they may be admirable, which I don't necessarily know if they are or aren't, because I'm not a member, but a lot of people swear by them, I still don't feel that they make Masons, they don't help the initiatic experience, and that we waste time and resources on them. And if they have any merit, they'll survive on their own.
One of the things that I think is interesting is this idea that they say that the DMLA is the future of Freemasonry. The data shows that's not true. John Ruark ran a bunch of survey data. We've seen other survey data that really shows that in the case that every DMLA joined Freemasonry, that's great, but that's not the case, and infrequently they get burnt out and they don't join, so that is interesting.
Here's the truth. We're talking about a very small number of guys anyway, so even if 100% of DMLAs became Masons, we're talking about trickle in terms of the bucket, right? They're not this massive organization that they want us to perceive, and I think a lot of that perception that they raise up Masons and that they still are, if you actually ask for a show of hands, how many brothers were DMLAs? Most 20%, 30% in the lodge. I don't even know if it's that many. I think it's probably fewer than that. I'm being generous. But like both my lodges, or actually any of my lodges, I'm a member of four lodges now in Texas, the vast majority of the brothers in those lodges were DMLAs. You hear a lot about DMLA, you hear a lot about using the lodge rooms for DMLA purposes and so forth. And I just feel like the more that we can take our administrative and collective focus away from these organizations, these peripheral organizations, and focus just at the core, which is Blue Lodge Masonry, particularly York and Scottish Rite, because I do think that they have historic and initiatic benefit, but really nothing much further than that. Maybe like AMD or so forth, but I think we really just need to do a good job at the Blue Lodge, and we've been floundering for a long time.
When we look at Masonry, let's assume that Masonry is around in 20 years, and let's assume that 18 is the general age that we can join. What does Masonry have to offer someone that's going to be born in 2021?
Well, first of all, I do believe, even though I said Masonry is dying, I don't believe Masonry will die. I think that dying implies a trajectory that if it isn't corrected, will result in total collapse. And whether or not there are five Masons left, we might still quote-unquote exist, but we're basically moribund at that point and irrelevant. I don't believe that'll be the case. I think Masonry has a future. What that future looks like and how influential we are depends on our choices now. So that's kind of just to encapsulate that philosophy. But what we need to do, you know, my opinion in the world of Lance Kennedy, is we really need to just, like I said, come to terms with the model of Freemasonry of the latter half of the 20th century and the last two decades of the 21st have been an abject failure overall. They have not attracted any number of men in any great numbers. And if we really want to get down to brass tacks, there are lodges that have been attracting men, but the model that they've been using is an outlier in terms of broader Masonry. So, you know, these are things like observant Masonry, formality, making sure that we, you know, reverence for the craft, mysticism, mysteries, and so forth, rigorous petitioning processes, higher dues, and so forth. Those lodges are actually growing. And, you know, like I said, it may be anecdotal because I don't have any evidence in front of me. However, I've been a Mason long enough and visited enough lodges to see and look around and say, hey, this lodge has a bunch of silver-haired dudes, and this lodge is full of guys under 35. And you can really see a radical difference in terms of what they're doing to appeal to those numbers. I think that we need to look at what's attracting millennial men in general, and I think that you and I can speak to that. I don't think that the Generation Z is going to be too much different, or even the generation after Z. I think that they're going to be in a world that is highly connected, highly impersonal, and a world where everything is given to them for free. So they want something that's valuable, something that is personal, something they have to work for, and is exclusive. Since the world that they live in is highly integrated, pluralistic, the world that they live in is highly integrated and has a lot of freebies given to them. The more that we can really advocate the fact that you have to work for this, this is something that is meaningful and valuable and will cost you, I think the better. And I know I'm going to get comments to the contrary. You've seen them. You know, brothers that say you should be able to come to lodge in basketball shorts, but
nope.
You know, I guarantee if you go to those lodges, they have very few, if any, numbers of young men involved.
I rarely get a chance to talk to somebody who I don't want to say this is an echo chamber, right? But it is interesting that here we are, both Masons of, you know, 11, 12 years respectively, separated by 7 years of birth and thousands of miles with very similar opinions of things. I'll tell you, when I came to my first meeting, I used to ride my bike to the lodge because we were in the city, and I rode my bike to the lodge on a night, it was a practice night, mind you. I wasn't even allowed in yet. I was an entered apprentice. So I had to sit out in the foyer and practice my catechisms with my mentor. And he basically told me that if I ever showed up in shorts again, he wasn't going to let me in the building. And I was just like, wow, okay. And that set a precedence for me right there, which I think is interesting, you know, when we see...
Yeah, okay. And not to interrupt you, but
yeah.
What your mentor did was beneficial for you because you understood this had value. And if you look at the way that many men, many Masons act about the fraternity, right, where they and let me give you an example, right? You may have seen that I posted a photo on the Texas Freemasons forum of a brother being installed as worshipful master, wearing shorts and flip-flops and a t-shirt. He was wearing his apron, but, you know, not much else. And I had such a backlash, you know, how dare you? You're trying to belittle this brother and so forth. And I actually had no commentary. I just posted the photo. What these guys didn't understand was that the brother's wife took the photo of him and posted it as some sort of, you know, promotion, saying, look, oh, I'm so proud of my husband. He's being installed as a master. This photo was online for 6 months on his lodge's website, on his Facebook group, right, where anyone could see it. I'm the first one that addressed it and brought it up to him. And so all these brothers that were telling me you should have whispered wise counsel, my question is, why didn't you do it beforehand? I'm the first one that did it. We have a problem in our fraternity where we've become so lax and so comfortable with being casual. And not just like, you know, I get accused of being, I don't know, an elitist. I'm not an elitist, even though I use the word elite. I think any man should be able to be a Mason if he meets certain criteria, which does not include any type of profession or money background or the like. I come from a blue collar background. I do. Neither of my grandfathers finished high school. Neither of my parents finished college. One of my grandfathers was a cop. The other one was a railroad worker. I don't have this like pedigree, you know, that entitles me to something. I don't. But I still value the fraternity enough to demand a high level of protocol and so forth. Just because I understand that, A, it shows that we value it, but B, it actually helps me appreciate the work that I'm engaged in, which helps me get something out of it. So, like I said, I posted that photo. I got a lot of pushback because people thought that what I did was incorrect. What I like to tell them is, well, the only reason that you felt uncomfortable with that photo being posted was because you know what he was doing was wrong, yet you don't want to say anything to him. You just want to project onto me your discomfort.
Well,
if I posted a photo of a brother, you know, wearing a tuxedo, there wouldn't have been a single person accusing me of belittling. But the fact that he was wearing a t-shirt and shorts and flip-flops somehow caused that sort of reaction. I think it's very telling about the psychology of many Masons and so forth.
I think it's interesting, right? Like, if you just post a picture with no commentary at all, you start to see people's psychological reflection within their own commentary, what they're seeing in their own, like you said, they're seeing their own uncomfortable feelings about it, and they're echoing it, saying that you're showing something, when in fact, you just posted a picture.
And it wasn't even a picture that was taken illicitly. It was a picture taken by the brother's wife and posted on their lodge's Facebook group by himself. And here's the thing, I actually did have a conversation with the brother, and I took the photo down because he requested it. But here's the thing, he was unapologetic. He actually said that he doesn't understand why he was doing anything wrong, and quote, he had an engagement prior to that to his installation that caused him to be dressed like that. Now, I'm sitting there going, you're about to be installed as the master of a lodge. You can basically dictate that it get pushed back 30 minutes so you can be dressed appropriately. But we've become, like I said, so comfortable with what we're doing, and it's become so common that we have no concern about propriety and what we're doing. And the reason I advocate, you know, and this gets into another topic, dress codes and so forth, is that, you know, look, if you're going to an interview for most jobs, now maybe not all jobs, but most jobs, you know, a suit of some sort is the standard, what we consider business professional attire, okay? I understand there are some professions or some jobs that don't require that, but let's just say most jobs do. In the U.S., we're a service-based and service-dominated economy. That is the uniform of men when they go to an interview. It also is the uniform when we go to funerals and so forth. So when I advocate business professional attire, which is a suit with a tie, doesn't matter what brand it is, doesn't matter where you bought it, could be Goodwill, could be given to you, could be from your dead Uncle Ralph, I don't care. I just care that you wear the symbol of formality, which in our culture is a suit. It's not starched jeans and a t-shirt. It's not starched jeans and a button down. It's not overalls. It's a suit with a tie. And, you know, in Masonic terms, it should be a dark suit with a dark tie. But as long as you're wearing a suit, I'm not going to have any beef with you. I just feel that what we've done is we've, as I said, and I don't want to beat a dead horse as often accused of, but we've become too casual. We need to bring this back to where it is, and we need to take what we're doing seriously. And we'll start seeing results when we do that.
Well, I mean, you can beat a dead horse all day long if the horse is dead, right? I mean, it's not getting up and moving, or it's not being changed out for something new to beat on. So I also don't like it when people say, you know, you're beating a dead horse with this issue. It's like, well, I'm going to continue to beat this drum, right, until things change, especially if you feel strongly enough about that topic.
Well, why wouldn't they want you? Look, it might be a rhetorical question. Well, why wouldn't someone want you to bring up something like dress code? And why would they accuse you of beating a dead horse and browbeating you for bringing it up again and again? Because they don't want you to bring it up. They're uncomfortable with what you're saying. They want to continue business as usual. They want to be told that the type of masonry that has become commonplace in our society and, you know, most American jurisdictions is somehow stable and is thriving, and what they're doing is okay. But the reason I bring up numbers like I did in my article, Freemasonry is dying, and you don't like the term dying, I get it, but like, let's just say a decline, a serious decline, that if it isn't corrected, will end in some type of irrelevance, okay? The type of masonry that brought about that decline, whether it's an artificial, you know, we can say after World War II or not, but the type of masonry that became normative is not growing. It is not producing enough masons to keep our organizations alive. Something has to change, and I believe it has to be something drastic. And one of the most drastic changes we can make in a culture that we have is really elevate our dress code, because that will elevate the mental state and our participation in it.
So one of the questions I was going to ask you, Lance, actually, was if you could enact the one thing today and say, let's not talk about opinions that we'll get online or whatever. Let's just say if you are a fictitious Grand Master of the United States of America, a position that doesn't exist, but let's say you are and you get an edict and you get to make an edict to take one thing which you're hoping will have the greatest effect on the fraternity in the positive. What does that look like for you?
I only have one thing, correct?
You get one thing.
I would say raise dues to 500 a year at minimum. I think that if you did that, that would probably fix many of our problems, because it would, A, weed out a lot of dabblers, people that sit on the sidelines that aren't really interested in being Masons, but they maybe keep their $10 a month dues because it gives them something to do once in a blue moon. I think that would be a fix for that. I think it would help much of our budgeting issues. And I think it would also make mentalities change. People would sit and say, okay, well, maybe if I have to pay $500 a year, which isn't easy for me and it's not easy for most people, I think they might have a different attitude about what they're doing and take it a little more seriously rather than just being flippant about their behavior and dress and appearance and how we approach it and who we let in the fraternity.
Let's pull that thread a little bit. So when you say $500 a year, I automatically think, well, my cable is $1,000 a year, and I think that Freemasonry is unequivocally way more important than cable. I would give up cable if I had to. I'd pay my $100 a month if I needed to for Freemasonry. But when I tell people that, Lance, I get a lot of pushback, and they'll say, well, what are you saying? Are you saying that Masonry is not important to me? And all I'm saying is, well, if your thing is like the Sunday ticket for the NFL on your cable network, but you're unwilling to increase the price of your dues, I'm left questioning how much you love the fraternity.
Sure. Well, look. If we said 500, 1,000, I think we're both saying the same thing. Whatever the number
sure.
is,
yeah.
it needs to be dramatically different than what the average Mason is paying for dues. You know, in Texas, most lodges have, what, $120 a year, $10 a month.
And that's huge in some places.
40, 50 years.
That's a huge amount of dues. $120 is huge in some states. And that's like nothing.
No, it's nothing in it, but we've grown accustomed to living off the fat of previous generations. So, you know, you had these war chests and, you know, and bank accounts and so forth that accumulated for decades or 100 years plus. And we didn't really feel like we needed a change. But in Texas, for instance, they implemented, and I know I'm going to be corrected, but I believe in the 80s, they implemented the endowment program, which was originally meant to be some type of benevolence gesture towards your lodge after you die. But what it was promoted as was lifetime membership. Texas just raised the average dues, or excuse me, average endowment or life membership to $1,000. So for $1,000, you can be a Mason in a lodge and never have to pay dues again. But at that rate, your lodge actually loses money because of how much they actually have to pay back to Grand Lodge for your membership. We don't have sustainable numbers, whether it's dues or endowments or the like. We really have to change these dramatically.
Yeah, I ran an actuary for the state of Illinois. You know, the way we'll do that is we'll say, so you get a life membership, and it is billed as a life membership. A life membership is 15 years of dues. Or if you are within 15 years of being a 50-year member, then you pay that. But for an average lodge, let's say it's $100, so you have to pay $1,500 for a lifetime membership. The average return on that $1,500 is, 3.5% of their total investment of the lodge, which usually comes out to whatever it is. You know, it's, a lodge might have 50 life members, and some of them have been dead for years. And in those cases, you know, the lodge sees around $14 to $15 per member, when in actuality, the lodge needs around $67 per member just to be solvent to spread that cost over the membership. So
okay, but this goes back to kind of this mentality, and maybe it's different in Illinois than in Texas. But I have a solution for it, there are brothers that say we should just do away with endowments altogether, and that may be a solution. But you and I both are Massachusetts Masons, and for your listeners, I get accused all the time of being a Yankee, right? I'm not. I'm a seventh generation Texan. I am a Southerner on all sides of my family. I'm a son of Confederate veterans and Order of the Stars and Bars, you name it, right? I'm as Southern as you get in many ways. But one thing that Massachusetts does right, in particular my lodge in Massachusetts does right, is the way that they do life memberships. It's like a reverse life insurance policy. The older you are, the cheaper your life membership becomes. So first, you can't buy a life membership for the first 5 years of being a Mason. So you have to pay dues for 5 years at least. After which, there is a calculus done that determines how much your life membership is. So at 31, it's going to be much more expensive than if I was 50 or 60. Which makes sense because I have more, a longer life expectancy. In Texas, I guarantee if I brought that up, brothers would say I'm being unfair and elitist. You know, they'd bring up something like, well, we're supposed to meet on the level. Well, yeah, we're supposed to meet on the level, but I'm also not supposed to cheat the lodge.
Well, and
if I
were to
bring up so many of the bastardization of our ritual, such as, you know, and I don't want to get on it because it would just get me riled up, but things like, it's the internal, not the external that matters that qualifies a man to be a Mason. And they use that in terms of dress code. It just gets me going.
Yeah, there's don't get me started on that, Lance. Yeah, that's a hot one.
No, sorry. I'm not going to bring it up. I promise. I did.
But let me tell you, so when I run the actuary, it shows in Illinois that if you buy a lodge, a lifetime membership, your lodge doesn't see a single dime until 10 years after you're dead. And at that, it's like $15. So in Illinois, lifetime memberships kill your lodge. They're terrible for your lodge.
Well, then let me ask you the question. It's probably the same question that I would ask, you know, in Texas. Why don't they get rid of them or why don't they change them? I mean, it's probably the same answer, which is,
some brothers.
You know, how long is the term of an Illinois Grand Master?
2 years. Well, they serve two consecutive one-year terms if elected the second year, which they usually are.
Okay, so that's better than Texas where they serve one-year term. And what my point is that you have a hard time, if you're only in office 1 year, having any sort of institutional authority to make drastic changes. And what it ends up happening is most of these decisions go on to committees and sounding board and external organizations that act as policy-making bodies. So, you know, any type of drastic measure where if you had a strong leader would come in and say, hey, this is killing our Grand Lodge. This is a, you know, they might say it's non-payment of dues or throw off, you know, the burden on something else. But in reality, we have verifiable data, as you pointed out, your actuarial table, of a policy of killing your logic. Why not change it? Well, for politics, X, Y, and Z, well, who cares? Just do what you need to do. I mean, if the collective leadership of Grand Lodge in any state got behind a policy, you would be able to change it. But that's probably easier said than done. It just boggles my mind.
I would suspect that any Grand Master who would get up there and gavel and make a decision like that would probably risk something along the lines of any further Grand Lodge hopes or positions, titles, etc. We're really concerned about those things, which is pretty interesting in an organization that's supposed to kill our ego, right?
But my thought would be, if in my 10th proposition for Texas Freemasonry, I advocate for multiple years. I would actually like 5-year terms.
Wouldn't that be something?
You know, at least four, but you know, five plus. Because you'd be able to effectuate a plan, a course of action, and have continuity, right?
I believe you put in the Texas Freemasonry group a picture of a certain Duke who's been a Grand Master for how many years?
I don't know how long the Duke of Kent has been Grand Master, but it's a matter of decades.
Yeah.
Most grand lodges, the Grand Master served for 10 plus years. Some are life tenure positions. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but I do feel that 1 year terms or 1 or 2 year terms or so forth, it's so short that a Grand Master really has no chance to make a difference. And we've, in effect, you know, basically devolved power onto other bodies that, you know, maybe are, you know, and I'm not a fan of committee decision making, right? I don't feel like you can rule by committee. There'll never be decisive action, particularly when a crisis occurs. This is why, you know, if you went from the Articles of Confederation to our Constitution, is the Founding Fathers realized that in a crisis, you have to have a singular monarchical leader. And Freemasonry is no different. So I, you know, as I've pointed out, the trajectory of Freemasonry points to the fact that we're in a crisis and we need decisive leadership. And, you know, policies such as getting rid of life memberships or amending them to be beneficial for lodges and the Grand Lodge, I think requires that. So, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll take a further implosion to get to the point where people start wanting drastic action, but I don't see it right now.
It is interesting to note that we are commentators in a world right now in which it's glorious that we have the ability to do what we're doing and to make these commentaries, but I also see this strange, almost intuition that we won't be unlike people like Dwight L. Smith, who gave all the warnings and were ignored for generations to see what comes next. You know, are people going to talk about what we're talking about today? Are people going to be talking about your articles, you know, in 25, 30 years and go, wow, they had it all laid out. Why didn't they do something?
They might be. I mean, Dwight L. Smith, Technological Research. I mean, there have been these kind of, let's say, prophets on the watchtowers that have been shouting, you know, hey, this is what's going on. I think, though, when Dwight L. Smith was writing, things were not as, they weren't in the same position and critical juncture they are now. We still had a vestige of success and numerical, you know, prominence and so forth. We had Gerald R. Ford, president in the 70s. So clearly there was still some type of resonance with our political leadership and our general leadership, you know, across the country. However, as we look, you know, across the nation now, I mean, how many Masons are in Congress? How many Masons are in your state legislature? Very few, if any. I mean, Texas, I know there are a couple because I've sat in lodge with them, and our Secretary of Agriculture is as well, but there are very few actual Masons in positions of leadership. Our numbers are collapsing. Our organizations are faltering. I don't think we're going to get to the point where the ideas that you and I are talking about won't be implemented. My fear is that they'll be implemented too late. And, you know, whereas we need drastic consolidation now, maybe 20 years from now, Order East and Star would have fizzled out. There might be random chapters here and there, but overall the numbers are basically going to disappear. Maybe Demolay disappears, maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But I definitely feel like, yeah, there is that possibility that someday, 20, 30, 40 years from now, people are talking about this podcast and saying, why did they listen to them?
Yeah.
I hope not.
Yeah, I'm with you. I wrote something that will never get published, but, you know, at the end of it, I have kind of a piece that said, you know, we gave it our best shot. Trust me.
I would like to say that, you know, your fear is well-founded, right? I mean, we are supposed to give our best shot. And I had this constant accusation about some of my, you know, Article Freemasonry dying of being a pessimist and negative and so forth. If people knew me, they would understand that I'm a critical optimist, right? I'm very positive. I like to, you know, read Tony Robbins religiously and been to his seminars, and I take a lot of effort in cultivating a positive attitude and positive outlook. I also feel that being realistic is a component of that because, you know, we need to know where we're at and where we're headed in order to make the decisions that are necessary. But I don't accuse you because I know you understand that the data, but many brothers really don't believe that there's any problem with Masonry. They reply, hey, Masonry isn't dying. Look at my lodge. We just made 10 new Masons. Now,
in a one-day class.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, which is an attempt at Grand Lodges to rapidly inflate numbers and get dues for immediate kind of support rather than, as I said, making these hard decisions of, you know, maybe streamlining your charity, cutting expenses, getting rid of buildings, which we don't need. I'm a proponent of selling off assets that are liabilities in the sense of on our balance sheets. You know, buildings are not assets. They don't produce money, right? Our buildings cost money. They have insurance fees and electricity and cooling, heating, repairs, and so forth. You know, these are liabilities on our balance sheet. There might be more efficient ways to kind of deal with Grand Lodge functions and so forth. So, you know, there's many solutions, but whether or not they'll be listened to is another matter altogether.
I think that's the key place to put a bow on this, but I think what was interesting too, you mentioned like getting rid of buildings and things, and I always see these parallels within Freemasonry and in the outside world and business and all of these kind of things. You know, I want to say I read about it in Forbes, I read about it in Fast Company, there's a million other articles regarding two main things. I won't talk about workforce at home and contract work, but I will mention that they talked a lot about, in a minimum of 15 to 20 years, most companies are eliminating buildings without, unless there's a distribution center. There's just no need for the building.
No, there's not.
Because it's such an expense. And Freemasonry is not all that different. You know, you've got like, for instance, United Grand Lodge of England. A lot of lodges meet there all year long. They have quarterly meetings. But that doesn't mean they're not doing degrees in between. But that kind of model is just smart. And for whatever reason, we say it's like a justification. I'm okay with spending this money even though I don't have it because I'm emotionally attached.
And that's exactly right. It's about emotion and some type of semblance that we've maintained this status that we don't have. And look, I am all for maintaining historic buildings, right? I don't believe we should divest ourselves of the Hofstra Temple, for instance, or the Dallas Scottish Rite Cathedral. I do, or many lodge buildings. I do feel, though, that if you have a building that's used once a year that is at half capacity or less and is only going to get, have fewer attending members there, and there's one in particular I'm thinking about, and that's going to require tens of millions of dollars, literally. I know the figures, and I gave you the figures before, but if it's going to take tens of millions of dollars to repair and put in order, and yet you're going to have a quarter of the capacity filled once a year, just think to yourself, is that really a smart investment? Is there a wiser way we could use our money or our funds? And my answer is yes. Instead of propping up a building like that, whatever you have to do to sell it off, you might not make a lot of money, you recoup some of it, and then invest it in an administrative structure you could run Grand Lodge out of, and then go rent a hotel conference center every year when you want to do a communication. You could move around the state. That's my idea. Now, there are political reasons why in Texas they won't do that because, for instance, the Dallas Masons won't bring as big of a delegation, for instance, if the Grand Lodges move from Waco to San Antonio, or, maybe it'll imbalance it and give East Texas and Houston more power if it's in Houston and so forth. There's political considerations. But I do feel that as far as our long-term sustainability, I don't feel that some buildings that we possess in mine and other jurisdictions are worth maintaining or keeping any longer. I think that's something to really seriously consider.
So, Lance, we talked about a lot of these other issues, but something that seems to really stick out that we didn't touch on this evening is the idea of education in lodges, what that consists of, and its importance. How do you feel, like, in the Masonic experience, fans of this show usually agree with me that Freemasonry is education. How do you feel? And I'm okay if you disagree.
Sure. I mean, I 100% agree with you. But when we talk about education, there are multiple ways we can be educated. There's education through memorization and lectures and learning in that sense. But there's also what we have as initiatic education, so to speak. And when, one very, critical aspect of Freemasonry that I think gets put to the wayside is the distinction between ritual and esoteric. A ritual and initiation. We have a lot of great ritualists, but the ritual that they perform is dead ritual because they really don't understand the components and what they're performing. Okay, so they might have everything memorized perfectly, but they really don't convey it in a way that's extremely powerful. We're not just putting someone through the ropes in order for them to be able to sit and lodge and vote with us on the next fish fry. We're putting them through an initiation in order to transform them as an individual. And this is why the initiatic experience is so powerful. And one of the most beneficial, quick, and long-lasting ways we can immediately increase our retention is make our ritual more solemn, some more powerful and potent, put more emphasis on the preparation of the candidate. I'm a supporter of Chambers of Reflection. I think that it's a great way to create a liminal period, a liminal phase between the outside world and the initiatic experience. It also puts men in some sort of meditative and also a psychological framework that's conducive for initiation. And when I use the term initiation, I'm not just speaking of going through a ritual to become a Mason or become something else. I'm talking about the concept of initiation as a journey inward, so to speak, into the depths of our soul and our psyche and so forth. If we put more emphasis on making our initiations more powerful and potent, I think we'll have better retention. And that's something that I think, in addition to dress code and high dues and so forth, we would do very well to start advocating and implementing.
Yeah, I love what you have to say there about the importance of the initiatic experience. So much of my research in the last 12 years has been on either Legend of the Word and all of these things, but necessarily when you trace those origins of what we do in Freemasonry in terms of the ritual, it is not unlike anything that, of course, came before it, which you name the rite, whether that's a Greek right, Eleusinian or Dionysian or, you know, Mithras and the Roman cults, all of these things, Egyptian, the rite of Black Memphis, all of these things that existed to impress upon the candidate a revelation that is supposed to be conveyed in such a powerful way to transform the individual for the rest of his life. And, you know, we don't do that by simply making fart jokes and goat jokes and mid-ritual have some guy screaming out how you got it wrong or, you know, to do something a little differently is loud enough for the candidate to hear 10 times over. It just feels so, I can't say what I want to say because largely there are people listening to this with kids in the background, but it is so disheartening and disgusting when we do that kind of thing. And if we could make it a 10 every time. You know, I was at a third degree just 2 weeks ago where the degree was so incredible. Very rarely does a candidate actually stand up and you can feel the emotion that he has when he says something like, nobody's ever done this for me before. This was incredible. You changed my life tonight.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's reintroducing mysticism into what we do. And, you know, I come from a state and a region that has a extremely evangelical base. Which, you know, if you look at the religious context of evangelicals, it's a very unmystical type of worship experience, right? Mysticism is not a part of most Protestant forms of worship. So I think that translates to the type of masonry, that there's a fear of the mystical, that somehow the mystical opens you up to experiences that are ungodly or so forth. But when we can actually, you know, speak of mysticism in a purely psychological fashion, which is, how do we make good men better? And that's, you know, if we want to call it the initiatic experience, that's what it is. It's taking an individual from the rust to perfect ashlars. But to do so, as you keenly pointed out, it takes a solemnity, a seriousness, a focus, a decorum that is frankly sorely lacking in many lodges. And, you know, I brought up John Colbert earlier in this podcast. I was touring St. Marcus Lodge when I was there for a conference, and he brought up to me that the very first thing they did when they renovated their lodge room was to renovate the room where the candidates prepared. And they hung up, they cleaned out all the junk in it, they put up curtains, they made it a very nice, comfortable, but, you know, kind of dark-feeling room. And in that sense, he said it had an immediate impact on the quality of their initiation. So that was a very insightful piece of knowledge. If you're listening and you have a lodge and you really are thinking about, hey, how do I improve our experience for our candidates? Maybe you just start there. You have that preparation room. Clean out the junk. Use a different storage room. Make that solely for the preparation of candidates. And I think you're going to have a much better, much more effective initiatic experience from that point. And then that'll translate to better ritual and so forth. But that's a good starting point.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to stop for the evening. I feel like we hit on so many great topics here in this particular program. We could probably split it up and talk about a number of these things on several episodes. I certainly hope you'll consider coming back on the program in maybe a month or two, a couple, maybe 3 months, and we can talk a little bit about how this latest article has created any stirrings or communications. Brother Lance, thank you so much for coming on the program.
It's a pleasure. I'm happy that you wrote an article critiquing mine, because otherwise I wouldn't have known to reach out to you and speak to you about it. It was an honor having someone of your stature think and relate to what I was writing, and I'm just grateful to be here and be able to talk about these topics with you and your listeners.
It was absolutely my pleasure and my honor. Everybody out there listening, I urge you to check out these articles. Of course, we're going to have them direct linked in the show notes. Of course, the 10 propositions for Texas Freemasonry, Freemasonry Dying, and 2 trajectories, we'll have that in. And, of course, any other articles that Lance decides to put out will link up there as well. Really looking forward to the rest of your works, brother.
Well, maybe you'll have me write some articles for your site.
Anytime. You have an audience, so we welcome a guest contribution.
Great. I'll think of something good for you.
All right, thanks so much.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
All right. My heartfelt thanks as always goes out to our guest. Lance Kennedy is extremely busy. If you would like to check any of his books out, his articles, we have links to everything in the show notes. I encourage you to check that out. He's a very interesting individual, a learned individual, and we could have talked for hours. In fact, I have no problem telling you that after this interview wrapped, he and I talked probably for another 30-35 minutes off the record. We had just so many points to talk about. So if you ever get the chance to hang out and have a beer or something with Brother Lance, you should do that. It's a good time. And I encourage you to subscribe to the websites where his articles are going up and check those out whenever they pop up. He's got some really interesting ideas. So I hope you really enjoyed this first episode of 2019. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to wcypodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Bankers Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Banker's Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to wcypodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Banker's Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code that's on it. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. With that, I'd like to bid you all adieu until next week. If you like Masonic podcasts, obviously you do, please consider checking out the Masonic Roundtable. We go live every single Thursday at 9:30, 8:30 Central. You can interact live with us by following the YouTube chat that runs along the YouTube live video as it records. And if you're not into YouTube, well, then find us on iTunes. It's there also, just like this show. I don't know how you're consuming it, whether that is on YouTube, many thanks to our YouTube subscribers, or it's on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you're getting your podcast feed. Thanks so much, especially to those of you who have been supporters of our app for so long. Very much appreciated. How do you get the app? Well, I'll tell you real quick. You're going to go to your App Store or your Google Play. You're going to search for an app called Podcast Source. Once you have that, you're going to search within the app for our podcast. That is, Whence Came You, with a question mark at the end. When you find it, you're going to add it to your shows. It's totally free. What's great about it is we add, in many cases, the papers that we read in every episode as a PDF document for you to download right there in the palm of your hand, so you can read that in Lodge if you want or whatever. Additionally, we have a Masonic-themed wallpaper for your mobile device. Those get a little bit difficult to create every once in a while. After 8 years of doing this program, you can imagine images and stock images start becoming very sparse, so I have to start making things in Photoshop. That doesn't take a long time, but it's effort nonetheless. So if you are somebody who enjoys all that content, thanks for considering donating or at least sharing the show with some of your best brothers and friends. Maybe share the show with a person interested in Freemasonry. Pick out your favorite episode. Pick out something interesting. Tell them, give this one a listen. I'd like to also ask everybody to check out the Midnight Freemasons, where we publish 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We've got a slew of great authors. We're going to have Lance Kennedy on as a guest contributor at some point in the future also. You heard us allude to that in the interview, which should be a highlight of our week. Coming very soon, there'll be a standalone Echo application that'll allow you to stream this podcast by just asking it to play it. And the cool part is, it's not like TuneIn, where if you stop, you have to start all over at the beginning again when you want to start listening again. This app will actually remember where you left off. It's going to be really cool, especially for some of you who got that special invite from Amazon to get the In Your Car Echo, which just clips on your old air vent and uses your cell phone connection to connect to the network. Of course, you can just use Google or Siri to do that as well. Anyway, I hope you guys all had an amazing holiday, but it's back to work for most of us. And so I'll see you guys in the quarries. Until next week, stay on the level. For Once Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.